This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our weekly director's cut of the show, a selection of carefully curated conversations from the archive. First, why fireflies are in danger. Then, the secret to using humor at work is to think funny, but not be funny. What's the difference? We'll find out. Also, Americans have the right to be tried by a jury of their peers, but juries rarely represent the racial and ethnic makeup of their communities. We'll find out how juries work. That's ahead on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Thanks for tuning in. Biologists worldwide have noted a decline in fireflies, which feels a little like magic is disappearing from the universe one blink at a time. If you've been out in the woods and suddenly seen the fireflies blinking on at dusk, it's a sight you cannot forget. What is killing the fireflies? I spoke with Tufts University biologist Sarah Lewis last year. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. Can you describe your most memorable firefly encounter?
Ooh, so many. As you say, they are one of the most charismatic creatures that we have on the planet. And, you know, even for people who don't like insects, and, you know, there's a fair number of people who don't really like insects, I've never met a single person who doesn't love fireflies. And, I didn't grow up paying attention to fireflies. Lots of people have, they have these like very nostalgic, wonderful childhood memories of fireflies. I didn't have any of that. I didn't actually even notice fireflies until I was a graduate student. I was living in North Carolina, and I was sitting out on my back porch one evening. It got there was a thunderstorm coming, so it got really, really dark. And then all of a sudden, from the grass, all of these flying sparks just rose up out of the grass silently, and I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like it. And, it took me actually quite a few years to get back into studying fireflies or to get around to studying fireflies. But that was really a magical moment for me. And it just made me wonder about so many things, you know, like how do they make light? How do they, who are they talking to with that light? You know, what are they saying? So many questions just like popped into my mind. And so that's when I really kind of, I started falling in wonder with fireflies.
Is the flashing always about communication? That's what they're doing, is talking to each other.
Well, actually, you know, yes. The fireflies use light for a couple of different purposes. One so the adults mostly use light as a courtship signal. So the males fly around and they flash in a particular pattern, and the females look for males flashing exactly the right pattern, and then they respond with a flash of their own. It's sort of use the light like texting back and forth. But fireflies in general, and especially juvenile fireflies, which also light up, they use the light for an entirely different purpose, which is for protection. So you can imagine that at night, in the dark, if you are poisonous or distasteful and you're trying to ward off potential predators, it wouldn't do much good to have, you know, the typical sort of orange and black and red coloration that a lot of poisonous animals have converged on. So,
'cause it's dark. You can't see the color in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. No reflected light. So fireflies make their own light as a warning signal. Fireflies are distasteful. They're toxic. And so it's like a warning to predators at night in the dark. It sort of shouts out like a neon sign, "I'm toxic. Don't eat me."
Yeah. Is it the lighting, the phosphorescent stuff that's toxic?
No. They're like these bags of like magical chemicals. They have so many cool chemicals. So no, the chemical reaction that makes the light involves an enzyme that's called luciferase. And the toxin is a completely different chemical that fireflies have invented over evolutionary time, and it's more like a toxin that some frogs have or toads have. It's related to a kind of bufo toxin, and it's very distasteful and poisonous for vertebrate predators. So birds, frogs, toads, lizards don't eat fireflies at all.
How closely are fireflies related to houseflies or dragonflies?
Okie dokie. So, all of those insects have fly in their title and their common name, but fireflies actually aren't flies. Sometimes they're called glowworms. Some species of fireflies are called glowworms. They're not worms. And they're sometimes called lightning bugs. They're not bugs. So fireflies are actually beetles, like ladybugs and other beetles. And so you can tell that they're beetles if you've ever seen a firefly close up and personal, because they have they fly with just one pair of wings, and the other pair of wings has been modified into a sort of a hard structure, a sheath that folds down. When they're not flying, it folds down over and protects the delicate hind wings when they're not flying. So, yeah, they're beetles. If you look at them, they've got those, you know, two little wing covers, and they walk around. They fly just like beetles.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're insects, so they're related to all those other flies, but they
no.
belong to a really, really diverse group of insects,
yeah.
which is the beetles.
And the threats that fireflies face, you've identified in some recent publications based on surveys of experts around the country, people who are kind of looking and trying to, you know, assess whether or not fireflies are healthy or not. What are the primary threats that you've identified?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm really lucky to be working with a global group of firefly experts around the world. And what we did is we conducted a survey of about 50 experts in firefly biology and conservation around the world. And we just asked them, you know, what do you think are the most important for fireflies in your particular, you know, country, in your region? What are the most important threats to fireflies? And when we collated the results, we were kind of surprised that there was a lot of consistency across all of these different. There's 2,000 different species of fireflies around the world. So many different species, many different habitats that they live in, lots of different behaviors, lots of different kind of lifestyles. And so, but we were surprised that. Consistently, everyone recognized habitat loss and degradation as the major threat for fireflies.
So what does that mean? Give an example of that, if you would.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a problem especially for fireflies that are specialists in particular habitats. So, for example, in Southeast Asia, there are some congregating mangrove fireflies, and they live along tidal rivers that are bordered by mangrove forest. And they're really, really cool. They're a tourist attraction. They've been written about by naturalists for hundreds of years. The males, thousands of males, gather in particular mangrove trees, and they light up the entire tree with their flashing every single night, night after night after night, trying to attract females. Females fly into these trees and then pick a male to mate with. Their whole life cycle, the female then goes and lays her eggs in the muddy riverbank. The eggs hatch out into juvenile fireflies called larvae. They live their entire life cycle in that just along the riverbank, like just back from the edge of the river. And they eat a particular kind of snail that only lives in that habitat. And then when they get big enough, they metamorphose into adults, which fly back to the display trees. So their whole life cycle plays out in this one specific habitat. So you can imagine if you erase that habitat or cut down the mangrove forest, replacing it with, for example, an oil palm plantation, which is happening in lots of Southeast Asia, or a, you know, fish farm or a shrimp farm or something like that, then the habitat that those fireflies need to survive is gone, and the fireflies are going to disappear too. They can't just pick up and move to, you know, shrimp farm or another habitat doesn't have the things that they need to survive.
Is that true? So, is habitat a problem for fireflies in North America?
Yeah, so there are about 150, 170 different firefly species in North America, and some of them are also habitat specialists. So, but some of them aren't. And so for fireflies that are, you know, can live in a bunch of different places, habitat loss isn't so much of a problem. They could, they can live in backyards. They can live in, median strips of highways. We're in the east coast of the United States. We're lucky enough to have a firefly called the Big Dipper firefly. And its scientific name is Photinus pyralis, and it's great because it can live anywhere. It lives in fields. It lives in cities. It's in, you know, urban parks. So that some fireflies are doing quite well. It's not like all fireflies are threatened by all of these threats.
A couple of other threats that you identified, and before we run out of time, I just want to touch on them very briefly. So light pollution and pesticides. Very quickly, what happens with light pollution?
Okay. Light pollution is a bit of a surprise, right? Even though we know that artificial light at night has increased exponentially all around the world, we were surprised that so many people considered this to be a major threat to fireflies. And the reason it is that fireflies use light to communicate. And if they can't see each other's courtship signals, then they're not going to be able to reproduce successfully. The other thing, pesticides, as you mentioned, is the third major threat that we identified. And pesticides is kind of, you know, people don't really think about fireflies getting exposed to pesticides, but you have to remember that the juvenile fireflies, actually, for all of the North American fireflies, live underground. And so it's in the ground that they are exposed to pesticides, and they spend the majority of their life cycle, actually, is spent underground. They only spend a couple of weeks out as adults, and they spend about 2 years living underground as larvae. So if you are applying pesticides to your garden or your lawn, insecticides, broad-spectrum insecticides are also going to kill firefly larvae.
Are they at risk of going extinct? Fireflies.
So I just mentioned that there's 2,000 different species, and they're not at risk. All of these species are not going to go extinct. The reason for focusing on identifying the threats is that we're in the process. Again, a group of firefly experts from around the world, we're interested in trying to identify the species that are most at risk and then prioritizing our conservation efforts on those particular species. So by identifying the threats, by knowing about the biology and the life cycles of all of these different fireflies, we can say, okay, well, these are the ones that are just doing fine. These are the ones that are likely to be in trouble. And how do we protect habitat for these? How do we keep artificial light from their habitat? How do we reduce pesticide use in these areas for the fireflies that are, in fact, at risk of extinction?
Sarah Lewis is a professor of evolutionary and behavioral ecology at Tufts University. She's a firefly expert. I spoke with her in February of 2020. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly staff picks version of the show. Coming up in about 15 minutes, Americans have the right to be tried by a jury of their peers, but juries rarely represent the racial and ethnic makeup of their communities. Why is that? Just ahead, the secret to using humor at work is to think funny, but not be funny. There is a difference. You're tuned to Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's good to have you with us today. We are all looking for a bit of relief in these confusing and chaotic times, but humor is tricky because it can come off as tone deaf. Somebody is bound to be offended by whatever light you try to make of a tough situation. Word of advice, do not be that person in your office right now, cracking wise. In fact, trying to be funny is a terrible business strategy, says Peter McGraw. He runs the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, HURL for short. What McGraw says you should do is think funny, and his latest book explains how. It's called Shtick to Business. I spoke with him last year just after it came out. So what is the difference between being funny and thinking funny?
Well, being funny is great if you can pull it off. And so the work that I've been doing for many years just shows how difficult it is to be funny to a broad array of people. And I had this insight where, you know, for most people, their professional problems aren't really best solved by comedy. They're best solved by creativity. And the masters of comedy are among the world's most creative people. And so what I discovered is that we can learn a lot from these funny people, not about being funny, but about thinking in different kinds of ways, being more creative, being more innovative. And that seems to be really quite important these days, I think.
Can you share an example of a comedian thinking in a funny way?
Sure. Well, so the act of comedy is the pursuit of novelty, right? So comedians can't tell the same joke over and over again in the same way that Starbucks can sell the same pumpkin spice latte over and over again. And so they're constantly on the search for new ways of seeing the world. One of those ways that I write about, I call it the reversal, or I encourage people to reverse it. That is to produce an opposing perspective. Hmm. And so what happens oftentimes is comedians, when they're making their jokes or creating a premise for a movie or a sitcom or a comedy sketch, use the reversal. Well, the reversal can be useful for more than just comedy.
Let's hear an example of that, and then we'll talk about how we might be able to put this into practice outside of telling jokes. So here is a clip from the 2015 Golden Globes. So this is comedian Tina Fey announcing a Lifetime Achievement Award for George Clooney.
George Clooney married Amal Alamuddin this year. Amal is a human rights lawyer who worked on the Enron case, was an advisor to Kofi Annan regarding Syria, and was selected for a three-person UN commission investigating rules of war violations in the Gaza Strip. So tonight, her husband is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Which is a great burn there.
Like, it is. I could just imagine what the limo ride on the way home from the Golden Globes was like that night.
All right. So
yeah, that's a great example of a reversal. It's something that comics do naturally. They either have that natural instinct or they learn it. It's like comedy 101. But it can be used for more than just comedy. And that's where I think that's where thinking funny becomes valuable.
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit more about the strategies here, how that works, how you would pull that off in a way other than on stage as a comedian. But before we go any further, I think we should probably establish a few of the basics. You have a theory about why we laugh at some things and not at other things. Explain the theory
for us.
Indeed.
Yeah, so this is part of the reason why comedy is so difficult. So comedy arises from things that are wrong yet okay, or what we call benign violations. And so laughter sits in this sweet spot between just okay, boring, causing a yawn, and just wrong, a violation, right? Outrage and disgust and anger. And so comedians are really great at crafting these benign violations, these things that are just wrong enough, just okay enough. The average person has a harder time doing that, and both groups have a hard time doing it because what's wrong and what's okay, what's a benign violation, depends on the audience member. It depends on the culture they're part of, the context they're in. Are they at church or at work or in a comedy club? It depends on their mood. You know, it depends on what's happening in the world. And so hitting that sweet spot is a really challenging task. Basically, there are twice as many ways to fail than there are to succeed.
So how does any stand-up comedian manage to get the majority of a room to laugh at the same joke when all those other things you mentioned could determine whether or not people find something funny?
Well, the first thing is obviously they have kind of natural ability and instincts that the average person has, but that's not enough. What they have, what they do is really fascinating. They've been doing what Silicon Valley has just recently started doing, That is that they engage in this kind of agile mindset. They are constantly testing their jokes as what a Silicon Valley person would call a minimum viable product. Hmm. In the book, I like to say that vaudeville was the first lean startup. That is that a comedian doesn't wait to tell a joke for the first time while they're taping a special. When they're taping a Netflix special, they know these jokes are funny because they've been trying them out on small comedy club audiences for months. And so what they do is they have a premise, an idea for a joke, they try it, and then they carefully pay attention to their audience, the customer. Does it get a laugh? Big, small, not at all. And then decide, okay, this is not working, I'm going to drop this. Or let me adjust this a little bit and try it again with another audience.
And where do you and I as employees workshop our ideas? We don't have, you know, comedy clubs on the road where we do that.
Yeah, indeed. Now, the point of doing this is to what I like to say, limit your downside risk. You know, so you want to have these small failures. You know, testing a joke in a comedy club is a small failure. And so at work or in your professional life, you want to try things out. You want to get them out into the marketplace and pay attention to what customers think. So sometimes that might be, I have a business idea. I'm going to put up a website and just say, coming soon, enter your name and email when you want information. And then I might run some Google ads pushing people to that website. Do people sign up? Well, maybe I have an idea that's going to meet needs in the marketplace. Does no one sign up? Well, now I've only wasted, you know, a few hundred dollars trying this idea out, you know. And so looking for opportunities to test things in small markets, you know, not hiding them away for the big Apple iPhone-style launches, but rather, you know, putting them out there and paying attention in the same way that a comedian pays attention when trying a joke for the first, second, third time.
One of the strategies that you point out that works both in comedy as well as in business is it's a kind of comedy reversal, like we talked about a moment ago, where you sort of flip what's expected. This is what you call turning a bug into a feature. And I want to play an example of this that you pointed out in the book. And it's really quite hilarious. So this is a television ad from the 1990s. It's a real television ad for a cough syrup called Buckley's. Let's have a listen to that.
Hi, I'm Frank Buckley, and this is Buckley's Mixture. If you've never tried it before, you're going to be very surprised. Twice. You'll be surprised at how quickly and effectively Buckley's relieves the nastiest coughs due to colds, bronchitis, and even smoker's cough. But just before you're surprised at how effective it is, you're going to be very surprised at how it tastes. Buckley's Mixture. It tastes awful, and it works.
It tastes awful. All right, so talk us through the strategy there.
Yeah, it's fascinating. This is one of my favorite lessons from the book. And so comedians constantly turn their bugs into a feature. That is, they turn a weakness into a strength. So when a stand-up comedian gets on stage, he or she will often point out how they're too tall, too short, too fat, too skinny, too hairy, too bald. They're going to point out their weakness, what's wrong with them, in order to turn it into a laugh. And that's really what Buckley's is doing here. They were sitting around number 9 in the marketplace for Canadian cough syrups. One of their problems was their cough syrup tasted terrible. Instead of trying to fix that bug, that weakness, you know, they could add a bunch of sugar and cherry flavor to it. Instead, they turned it around and turned it into a feature. That is, boy, this cough syrup works. How do we know it works? Because medicine should taste awful. The best medicine doesn't taste like candy. It tastes like medicine. And so they ran a whole campaign. Buckley's went to number 1 in the marketplace. It was incredible.
Are there any other examples you can think of how this would work in the real world?
Well, you know, what was really fascinating was Google had a problem with Gmail early on. The engineers could not figure out why there was a delay between pressing send and your email going out to the world. And that's a pretty big weakness, as you might imagine. Well, what the Google engineers did, especially to give themselves time to problem solve this, they introduced an undo send feature, which allowed you to take back an email that you had sent inadvertently too early, or you had sent and then immediately regretted.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. So all of a sudden, it's the only email service that lets you, that gives you a chance to take back.
A second chance.
Yeah.
A second chance.
And then they marketed it that way, or at least they created a feature around that.
That's exactly right.
Amazing. Speaking with Peter McGraw, he is a humor expert, a behavioral economist. He runs the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder and has a new book called Shtick to Business, which is about some of the lessons we can learn from comedians about how to think more creatively in our own lives and in our business lives. So another of the comedians that you encourage people to take a lesson from is Jerry Seinfeld. Here is one of his classic bits.
On my block, a lot of people walk their dogs, and I always see them walking along with their little poop bags, which to me is just the lowest function of human life. If aliens are watching this through telescopes, they're going to think the dogs are the leaders. If you see two life forms, one of them's making a poop, the other one's carrying it for him, who would you assume is in charge?
Peter McGraw, what's the lesson from Jerry Seinfeld?
Well, Jerry has this saying that comedians are not aliens, they're not humans, they're humanoids. That is, they don't quite fit into the world, and as a result of not fitting in the world, they get to see the world in a different kind of way. They're able to sort of step back and see the kind of peculiar things in the world, as demonstrated by, I think, that very funny bit that holds up pretty well today. And so what I think a lot of good businesses do, and certainly good entrepreneurs do, is they pay attention to the things that just seem a little bit strange about the world. They see opportunities that the average person doesn't get to make. And as a result, it gives them an advantage in the marketplace.
There's a really interesting case study that you share in the book about a company that makes convection ovens.
Yes, I love this story. It's not a well-known story. The company is called TurboChef, and they essentially have invented an oven that is nearly as fast as a microwave, but doesn't make the food soggy. And so they created this oven. It's a fantastic oven, but it was just too expensive to try to sell to people for their homes. And so that's a major problem, because people aren't going to spend $3,000 or $4,000 for a convection oven that's just going to heat something up really fast. And so what they decided to do was to find maybe a business that could do this, and they identified the perfect business: Subway. Right, so Subway at the time was getting lots of competition from Quiznos, because Quiznos had sandwiches, but they would heat them up and make them warm and delicious. And so the company went to Subway. Subway balked at spending, making this huge millions and millions of dollars of capital expense outlay for this. And, you know, TurboChef could have given up, or they could have just seen the world in a different way. And what they realized was, oh, can we create a win-win-win situation? They approached Coke and said, we know that you want the soda contract for Subway, which was currently in Pepsi's hands. Why don't you buy these convection ovens for Subway, and then we'll get them to switch over their soda contract? Right? And so now everybody wins, right? Subway gets the ovens, Coke gets his contract, and TurboChef gets its contract also, and then obviously, Subway patrons end up getting warm, delicious Subway sandwiches that they could only at that point have gotten at Quiznos. Unfortunately, the only person, or actually entity, that loses
is Pepsi.
Is Pepsi. Yeah.
Yeah, they got outsmarted, I guess, in that deal.
Indeed.
It seems to me, though, Peter McGraw, like comedians and entrepreneurial types that are really great at inventing solutions and coming up with, you know, new things that we all absolutely need, or finding ways to solve a business problem. It seems to me like, to some extent, they are just naturally good at seeing the world differently, at flipping what's expected a little bit, right? I mean, is there a way? I'm just not one of those people. when you tell the story, I'm like, well, duh, of course. Or, you know, that's a hilarious joke. It's not all that complicated. Of course, Jerry Seinfeld's right. But on my own, I am hard pressed to come up with anything that creative. Is there some way that we can teach ourselves to be this way?
Yeah. So first of all, I would say don't give up just because it doesn't feel natural. So first of all, there's sort of the myth of the young entrepreneur, right? So the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world are the exception, not the rule. Most entrepreneurs have had failed businesses or are in their 30s and 40s. The world's best comedians have been doing comedy for 10 plus years. So they may have some natural abilities, but these are things that they develop. These are skills that they have. So I recognize that also. So I've done a couple things with Shtick to Business that I think will help. So one of them is that in every chapter I have a section in which I kind of guide you through some of the lessons with some questions that you can work through.
It's so like a worksheet to try to maybe crack the window just a little bit and let me see things differently.
Yeah, so just like trying to make these things a little bit more applicable for regular everyday people like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I've done, by the way, I call that section "Develop Your Shtick," which I'm quite proud of that. I shouldn't be, but I am. The other thing is that so the book launches on April 1st, on April Fool's Day. People can go to, at that time, can go to my website and download a workbook that I've created that also will help people take them through some more of these kinds of lessons. But I think the most important thing is to recognize, even if this stuff doesn't come naturally, it's something that you can work on, because that's exactly what the craft of business and the craft of comedy comes from, sort of persistent work.
Right. You described the constantly refining and trying out, testing jokes and refining them the same way you might refine a business idea. I thought another thing was interesting that you pointed out, that sometimes comedians will establish rules for themselves, establish constraints in order to kind of force them to have to think a little bit more creatively. Can you share an example of that?
Yeah, so one of my favorites is clean comics. So one of the easy ways to kind of get a laugh in comedy is to go blue, is to talk about taboo topics and to curse on stage and so on. That provides the violations, you know, as part of the benign violation formula. Mm-hmm. But some comics, you know, Jim Gaffigan, Ellen DeGeneres are incredibly popular and incredibly funny individuals. And actually, in many ways, they're even more popular, right? Because they can cut across many different types of people with their comedy. They use a self-imposed constraint, which is to not go into the taboo and to not use curse words. And as a result of that, they have to work a little bit harder, but because of the harder work and because the constraint forces them to think in different ways, they often come up with sort of less obvious jokes.
Mm.
It's great.
Yeah. Like, okay, so here's an example of Jim Gaffigan. People, if they're familiar with him, he's got two themes he talks about a lot. One is food and the other is kids. They have a lot of kids, he and his wife. So here's a bit about the kids.
The best is when I'm alone with my five kids and inevitably struggling, and some stranger will come up to me and go, "Looks like you got your hands full." Why would you say that? It's like going up to someone in a wheelchair. "Looks like you don't do a lot of dancing." "Looks like you got your hands full." "Yeah, I could still punch you." But it is a lot of kids, you know?
I think he goes on and has a little bit of a bit about what it's like to have five kids and says, "Imagine you're drowning and someone hands you a baby."
Exactly. Right. Okay, so you lay out lots and lots of different ways in this book and through this conversation, ways that you can start to think about how to think differently in order to be more creative. And certainly there can be lessons here if you're trying to come up with an ad campaign or, you know, a branding or a new product. Is there any way in which thinking like this has helped you just in your life as a person?
Yes. I mean, in so many ways. I mean, I've been doing this research for more than 10 years, and these comedians have become my friends and business partners. They really have been an inspiration to me in terms of for me to think differently about my career. I'll give you two very quick ones. The first one is the comics constantly carry around a notepad. Right? They're always writing ideas down and workshopping their jokes in written form. And I think that the average person, whether it be professionally or personally, and especially nowadays with all that's going on in the world, could really stand to put a pen to paper, to turn the phone off, turn the TV off, to get a little disconnected and slow down and put a pen to paper and write down how they're feeling, what they're noticing, what they're grateful for, what their dreams are, what's the sort of project, the dream project that they've always been thinking about doing, that there's power in writing that I think the average person doesn't realize that the average comic does. And then the second thing is that while comedians ask why when creating their comedy, they ask why not when living their life. That is, they're early adopters of ideas. You know, they were among the first to adopt podcasts. They are open to new experiences. And so they're focused on their dreams and achieving great things. And this is connected to an idea in the book that I call Take a Bigger Perspective. And that's something that I've really worked hard to try to do, is to be focused on achieving great things, not just avoiding bad things. And I think that that's an important thing that everyday people, whether you want to build the next Amazon or climb the corporate ladder, or you just want to live a better life, I think that notion of taking a bigger perspective is an important one.
That's Peter McGraw, professor of behavioral economics and a humor researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder. His book is Shtick to Business, which is published last April in 2020. And I spoke with him just after it came out. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Good to have you with us. Coming up next, selecting a jury is not supposed to be racially biased, but the results often do exclude women and African Americans. We'll hear how. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. It's our weekly director's cut of the show. The U.S. Constitution guarantees you the right to a jury trial in criminal cases. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that ought to be a jury of your peers. But juries are not assigned at random based on the community they're drawn from. If you're Black, there's no guarantee there will be any people of color on your jury, because lawyers on the case have a lot of power to pick and choose. They're technically not supposed to kick people off a jury because of race or gender, but University of South Carolina law professor Ann Eisenberg has evidence that women and African Americans are disproportionately removed from death penalty cases in her state, South Carolina. We spoke about it last year. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. Why would a lawyer not want an African American juror in a trial? Like, what would be a reason why they would even care what the race of a jury member is?
Yeah, so from a prosecutor's perspective, they're probably viewing this demographic as being more likely to be sympathetic to defendants, and then also more likely of the criminal justice system. So they might see having a higher proportion of African-American jurors as disadvantageous to the outcome they're looking for, which is typically a conviction.
Is that true? Are Black jurors more likely to convict to not convict somebody?
Yeah, so it is hard to generalize, but I think it is safe to say that people have different interactions with the police based on their backgrounds. They have different interactions with the court and the prison system based on their backgrounds. And it does seem to be confirmed through social science studies that yes, jurors, I mean, to be clear, no individual characteristic of a juror is going to decide, you know, point blank how they vote on a particular case. Most jurors look at the facts and decide a case based on the facts. Mm-hmm. But studies have shown that there are various likelihoods of making decisions in certain directions based on characteristics like race and gender.
How much more common is it for an African-American or a woman to be removed from a trial in the cases that you've looked at? You specifically looked at death, like capital death penalty cases, right, in South Carolina?
Yeah, I looked at death penalty cases in South Carolina, a set of 35 of them. So there are a lot of dozens of cases that I didn't look at, but this was the data I have available. One of the findings I had is that prosecutors used their ability to strike jurors against 35% of eligible African-American prospective jurors, compared to only 12% of eligible white prospective jurors. So that gives you a sense that's almost three times the rate in terms of prosecutors removing different groups. So that's a pretty big disparity, and that's pretty common in terms of findings from other studies of similar types of trials.
And when prosecutors are confronted with this data, what do they say? Have you asked any prosecutors given your data?
So I haven't spoken to prosecutors. There is a way for attorneys on either side to challenge if they perceive that this practice is happening, that the other side is systematically removing a group of a particular race off of the jury. That is unconstitutional. And so they can challenge it and say, hey, I think, you know, you're excluding all of the black jurors. That's unconstitutional. The prosecutor would then, and it typically goes in that order, the defense attorney challenging the prosecutor doing this, the prosecutor then has the opportunity to respond. Mm. And what they need to do is provide a reason other than race for those removals. So, for example, and it really can be anything, you know, that guy expressed a particular view that made me think he was biased, or that person you know, has a criminal record or something like that. So a non-race related reason, which is a legitimate reason for removing a prospective juror.
I'm hearing you say that it's really hard to prove racial discrimination or gender discrimination in these cases where jurors are removed from a jury by the defense or the prosecution, right? Like that, as long as they can come up with some other reason that's not race or sex related, then it'll stand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most attorneys are smart enough to not write down notes saying, you know, ha ha ha, we're going to discriminate now and get rid of all of the jurors of a protected demographic. Mm. And then the standard, this sort of, you know, call out and response can really let the party defending themselves or their practices come up with a pretextual reason. And courts are really pretty lenient about the reasons that they'll allow.
Do you think that these prosecutors in particular who are especially likely to disqualify African Americans disproportionately from jurors, do you think that they are that in their mind they're saying, I got to get as many black jurors off this jury as possible? They just aren't saying it out loud? Or do you think that it's somehow maybe it's not bias at all. Why can't we just take them at their word that in fact the reason why it just so happens that they're disqualifying more black jurors is because of all the reasons they listed out about those individuals, you know, positions and views and experience?
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting question. I mean, I would speculate in terms of what's going on in people's heads that it's the same spectrums of bias that we see anywhere else in our society. So I'm going to guess that there are some prosecutors who are saying, you know, ha ha ha, we have to do this thing, even though it's unconstitutional and we are consciously discriminating. I'm sure that there are others for whom it's more of an unconscious bias, which many of us have. And then there are correlations associated with race. For example, someone having had interaction with the criminal justice system may be more likely to have come from an over-policed African-American neighborhood. And so that was one issue in my study, is that I wasn't able to control for race-neutral you know, potential race neutral reasons that prosecutors might have wanted to remove people anyway.
How does this affect outcomes, though? So what you know, there are relatively fewer African Americans serving on juries because of the, you know, the challenges that prosecutors can make to jury service.
Yeah. So the implications are really huge. And so one question we should ask ourselves is, what's the point of juries at all? There are other legal systems that don't have juries. And ultimately, on the part of the juror, it's a form of civic participation. You're deciding the fate of your fellow citizens and people who live near you. And from the point of the justice system, it's a democratizing function. We historically thought of judges as being sort of elite and juries representing kind of the will of the common people. But juries are dangerous if you have only one majority group or a dominant group dominating the juries and then casting judgment on minority groups. It can also become a tool of oppression.
And there's a history of that, especially in the segregated South, where you would see all white juries not convicting people who had been involved in the lynching of a black person. Right. Even though there was there were witnesses and there was evidence that, and the person had maybe even said they were guilty, but a white jury would let that individual off. So there is at least historical evidence that a jury, an all white jury, can rule more harshly against a person of color.
Yeah, absolutely. And you highlight there are sort of two sides to this coin of the majority group over convicting the more vulnerable minority and a majority group under convicting members of their own. Hmm. And so history certainly bears this out. And then the social science studies suggest too that juries that, let's say, overrepresent whites or overrepresent men are more likely to even find a defendant guilty, which is concerning based on the Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury.
Hmm. So the problem here is that is that impartial jury thing. That's the constitutional right that we're all guaranteed, is an impartial jury. And then the question becomes, in order for that jury to be impartial, does it need to represent you in some way? Does it need to represent the community in some way? Why don't we have a rule that says that every jury within this particular county or state must, you know, be representative of the general population in that county or state?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And our constitutional standards that have been developed over the years haven't required that. Part of what's a little bit tricky is that the jury selection process has a bunch of different stages. Mm. And we kind of have different constitutional norms for each phase of the jury selection process. So the very first stage in jury selection, when you get that letter and say, uh-oh, I have jury duty, that they have to get your name on that list somehow, right? And so common ways to get that are like the DMV records or voter registration records. But already you have groups underrepresented at that phase, like the elderly or young people and students or people living in poverty. Hmm. The standard at that phase is you are entitled to, quote, a fair cross-section of the community. So not outright representative, but a fair cross-section. So it kind of struck a balance, but that does seem like it hasn't tilted the scale quite far enough in terms of representativeness and impartiality.
Okay. So the source, the initial pool that juries are drawn from is slanted or is not fully representative. And then once those potential jurors show up, they've been randomly selected because you got that letter in the mail, you show up, you're one of, you know, 100 or whatever that they've called in. And then one by one, the attorneys for both sides of a case have the right to eject people as long as they can come up with an excuse that's not based on race or sex.
Yeah. So the study that I did looked at three phases of the jury selection process. And I started thinking of getting to the jury box. And again, I think jury serving on a jury is, it's a right and a privilege. It's an important thing to get to do. I know we all kind of want to get out of it all the time, but in fact, it is an important vehicle for democratic participation. So I think of the trek to the jury box as a race that we want a good, diverse group of people to win. But the problem is that for different groups of people, each stage has different hurdles. So the first one is that veneer where groups are already underrepresented. The second one that I looked at is called voir dire, where there's a questioning phase. And the attorneys get to question the juror to make sure they don't have particular biases that might disqualify them. In the death penalty context, a juror can be dismissed if they don't believe in the death penalty, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's another problem, because race and gender are highly correlated with views on the death penalty. And then the phase you described is right after that, where, okay, we have a qualified pool of dozens of people, but now the attorneys, for no reason whatsoever, or they don't have to state a reason, they can just say, you know, I want to strike person number 12. The end.
And is that supposed to, both sides get to do that, right? So that's supposed to balance each other out at some point? Presumably you would have the defense attorney trying to strike some of the white people so they can have more people of color. But then you might have the prosecutors who are trying to strike more people of color, but in the end it should balance out.
Well, so that is kind of, so a lot of defense attorneys, one potential solution to all this discrimination is let's get rid of the strike phase. Maybe the strike phase where it's kind of, you know, lacking in transparency. Do we need it? Let's get rid of it. A lot of defense attorneys don't necessarily want to get rid of that phase because they want that power to strike jurors who they think are going to be detrimental to their client. Mm. But that is how it played out in my study, where I saw the prosecution strike all of the prospective African-American jurors they could, and I saw the defense counsel strike all of the white men that they could.
So we have about 30 seconds. What's one thing that would help? If we don't strike this, if we don't get rid of the strikes, what could we do?
My opinion is that we cannot reconcile these practices and the longstanding problematic effects that they have with administering capital punishment fairly. So if it were up to me, I would just say, whether you believe in the death penalty or not, we cannot implement it fairly based on these studies. So I would say that's a reason to abolish it.
Anne Eisenberg is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina. We spoke in April of last year. This is Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Every week, the Top of Mind team combs through our archives to select conversations that deserve another listen. This hour, some hospitals have their own leeches on hand for certain medical procedures. That's right, leeches are not just a medieval doctor's tool anymore. Also, how beavers migrating north in Alaska are melting the permafrost and accelerating climate change. Then a Super Bowl champ who says he's even more proud of his reading accomplishments than he is of that ring. It's all ahead on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Imagine you've just had reconstructive surgery to reattach a finger or graft some skin onto a badly burned part of your body. And in comes a nurse with a medical device to help your wound heal. You look at that tray and see a vial of greenish-black leeches. That's right, blood-sucking worms are officially sanctioned for medical treatment by the Food and Drug Administration. Reconstructive surgeon Jeffrey Janis at The Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center has developed some recommendations for using leeches safely. And we spoke with me about it in May of last year. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. This cannot be very popular with patients. You would absolutely have to sedate me first before you use leeches on me. How does that usually go down?
As you would expect, pretty much precisely like that. I think at that point, though, your listeners should be aware that this is not a first-line treatment. This is not the first thing that as you talked about, maybe the nurse would bring into the room or your doctor would order. This is something that's used in extenuating circumstances, really as almost a last-ditch effort in order to try to salvage potentially a reconstructive procedure that's not working out as well as was hoped. And this is the last line between whether something potentially can get salvaged or not. At that point, when properly explained to a patient and when facing the options of almost a certain failure versus a chance at a survival of the transferred piece of tissue, for instance, when you explain and educate that there is a method to this, there's a reason for this, and that there's actually FDA approval and science and evidence behind this, then it becomes a little bit less scary.
What is the extenuating circumstance where leeches would be your last-ditch effort?
So maybe an example is there's a piece of transferred tissue called a flap. So maybe let's use a practical example. Breast cancer is unfortunately very common in this country and may necessitate a mastectomy. And after mastectomy, women are eligible for reconstruction. One of the ways that we can reconstruct a breast is by transferring tissue from somewhere on one part of the body and moving it to another. So that's called a flap. So let's say the flap is transferred. In this case, let's just say that we're using part of the tummy. Let's just call it maybe a tummy tuck, except instead of throwing away extra skin and fat, you transfer it up to the breast and help use your own body's tissue to recreate your own breast, which is the reason to do this. Let's say that in the process of doing that, something doesn't go 100% according to plan, and it looks like the flap of tissue, that transferred tissue, may not make it. Now, let's say that you...
Why would it because it's died, because it doesn't have enough blood flow?
Dying, yes. Okay. I would say dying. So, you know, the most common operation, or one of the most common operations, would be to disconnect that tissue and reconnect it. So disconnect it from the abdomen and reconnect it up on the chest in the breast position.
Where you have to connect the veins and arteries so that it can get blood flow and become part of that area of the body.
Right. So, so that piece of tissue has an in and it's got an out. The in is the blood flow from the artery and the out is the blood that comes out of the flap through the vein. So you basically need two pieces of plumbing. Mm-hmm. So let's just say that despite everything that was attempted, that it looks like it's not going to make it, it being the piece of tissue. And that as a last ditch effort, you're going to try to save that so that you didn't go through all of that for nothing.
Right.
That's a situation where we may pull out the leeches in order to try to salvage that situation.
Well, what can a leech do in that case?
Yeah, so several things. You know, in a situation like this, the most typical reason to use a leech, and I'm going to use another analogy here to make it easy for the listeners, is envision a bathtub where the water faucet is on, and let's just say it's on full blast, but the drain is clogged. And so let's say you try as much as you can to unclog that drain, but the drain is not going to get unclogged. So what happens? The water in the bathtub builds up and it keeps getting higher and higher and higher.
You got to bail it out.
You got to bail it out. You got to build a new drain in it somehow. And no matter what you do to that original drain, it is just not going to work.
Okay.
So now let's say the leech is a way to build a new drain into the bathtub.
Because
so
the flap is filling up with blood,
with blood.
Out to the drain, the vein isn't working.
It's not working. Correct.
Okay.
You have it 100% correct.
Okay.
So in that situation, a leech is going to work in several ways. So first of all, it's actually going to suck blood. Well, that seems to be pretty obvious. But if you've never seen a leech before, they're not that big. They're not that long. And like anybody else, even the biggest human still gets full when they eat an all-you-can-eat buffet. So, you know, at some point, you're just not going to be hungry anymore or you're going to be too stuffed. So they are going to extract blood. And by that, I mean maybe about a teaspoon to three teaspoons, you know, which is a tablespoon. So somewhere between a teaspoon and a tablespoon of blood, it's going to help remove some of that water from the bathtub. The other thing it's going to do is it's actually going to dilate some of the blood vessels through a substance in its saliva called Herudin. And that is going to help create a bigger bathtub, if you will. So it's going to create more space. And it's also going to build a little valve in that bathtub that lets a little water just kind of trickle out for an hour or two.
After
you remove the leech.
The puncture wound will keep oozing from where the leech attached.
That's right. Because of that substance in the saliva, it's called an anticoagulant. So it basically stops the blood from clotting, which is Mother Nature's natural way of stopping you from bleeding. If you fell on the sidewalk and you scraped your knee, it'll stop. And that's what you want, actually.
And why wouldn't you just attach a drain, like a you know, to drain out the extra blood? Couldn't you put like a pipe in there or use some sort of a like a plunger, syringe to extract
it? I wish it was that simple. You know, the tissues though are filled with the blood. So it's not just in, let's say, a blood vessel where you could insert like a syringe or a needle or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be almost like a sponge. You know, so how do you soak water out of a sponge? It's not just going to be as easy as sticking a needle into it. You can do that, but, you know, you may need to use this other method.
Interesting. Okay, so in this case, leeches are the most effective way of sucking blood out of a sponge.
In essence, it's a salvage effort.
But the leeches are not going to build a new drain to allow for blood to flow properly. So you just drain out the blood using the leeches, and then hope that over the course of a couple of days, maybe the plumbing works its way out.
Yeah, essentially, you're buying time.
Okay.
You are waiting for your body to naturally grow blood vessels, i.e. new drains, even if they're small, into the piece of tissue that will help build new drains into that bathtub. So
how long would the treatment take place? Like how long would you have to sit there with leeches attached to your flap?
Well, so the average is going to be somewhere around 5 to 10 days. But
of constant leeches attached to you?
Right. That's right. So that's why this is a last-ditch effort. And again, you know, the first thing you would do naturally is go back to the operating room and try to do this with surgery. You know, if there's a problem with the vein, then you need to repair it. So let's make no mistake that the first line of treatment here, if this were to happen to anybody or it has happened to anyone, you'd go back to the operating room. But if you've tried everything and nothing else is working and the option is having this completely fail or having some chance at salvage, then that's where the leech comes in.
And how many leeches would be involved in a treatment like this?
It depends on the amount of tissue. So the bigger the piece of tissue, the more leeches you're going to need. The smaller amount of tissue, the less.
But if it's feeding, it'll have to get replaced every couple of hours, maybe?
Yeah, very labor intensive. You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah. You know, when the leech is done, then it would need to be replaced.
And what happens to the full leeches?
Yeah, you have to get rid of those.
Oh.
And there's a special way to do that. I mean, we don't just throw them in the trash can.
But it can't be reused. It can't go digest and then come back and suck more blood.
No. You would have to replace with a new leech. That's a one-time only use for that leech, and then that leech needs to be discarded. And that's why when you order leeches, it's more than just a little handful of them. You know, you have a bunch of them just in case you need several of these over a longer period of time.
Do the leeches stay put? How do you make them connect to what you need them to suck blood from and then stay there?
Yeah, so they what they don't like is basically grease or ointment, okay? So the skin, the piece of tissue that it's going to attach to, has to be clean. It can't have soap on it. It can't have gel on it. It can't have ointment like antibiotic ointment or anything like that. It can't have that. So the leech naturally is going to be attracted to blood. So it does that with a bite, and now whether it bites on its own or whether you maybe prick the skin a little bit to create almost like a diabetic who checks their blood glucose level has to prick their fingertip in order to get a small droplet of blood to test. It's very similar to that. You can kind of get it started with a little baby pinprick.
The leech will be attracted to.
That's right. Leech finds that, and then it stays attached until it's full. And when it's full, then it detaches. If you need to detach it earlier, you can.
It'll detach on its own. It'll just sort of roll back from the table.
You monitor it, but generally when it's full, it backs away from the table.
Okay. Does it hurt for the patient?
No. Most patients cannot feel this. They occasionally can feel some itching, but this is not something that's typically painful.
How many times would you say you've actually used leeches as a last-ditch effort?
I've been doing clinical practice since the late 90s, so I would say over 20 years. May have had the occasion to use it 15 times, 20 times, something.
And has it worked? How many of those cases would you say it's worked?
Yeah, I would say, you know, in my own personal experience, I think it has worked probably about 70% of the time, somewhere around there.
So why wouldn't it be a first-line defense? I mean, why would you go back to the surgery room and try to fix the vein if you could hook the leeches on and have such a great response?
Well, the, going back to the operating room has got, you know, a much more success rate, a higher success rate than 70%. I mean, okay. you can usually salvage these in the upper 90%. So first of all, it's going to be faster. Second of all, it's going to be better. And third of all, I think it's going to be more palatable. If you think about the first comment, that
just
you
less
made
traumatic to the
reaction,
patient. Yeah.
If you could go to the operating room and go to sleep and have this fixed for you while you're sleeping and wake up and you're good to go and you don't need leeches, I think you would probably find most people would prefer that than several days of having these guys run around.
Speaking with Jeffrey Janis, reconstructive surgeon at The Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, you just said these guys run around. So they actually do migrate? Like, is it possible that you'd wake up in the morning and these leeches have, like, gone to attach themselves to other places of your body?
So we obviously contain them so that that can't happen. So you, because
constantly, like, instance, monitored.
Well, but you know, like, so we build like a little moat around them of things that they don't like. So like if you want to put some ointment around in a circle, it almost like keeps them in that circle because they don't want to get near that. So there are ways to contain this so that you don't have them all over the place.
Do you have a specially trained nurse that's willing to do this?
I wouldn't say specially trained, but you certainly have to have a lot of direct communication. There are some nurses who have more experience than others. I think most nurses who've never been through administering leech therapy before and are unfamiliar with it, you certainly wouldn't want to do this without guiding them through that.
I'm sure they would just flat out refuse. Where do you even get the leeches for a treatment like this?
Yeah, so there are companies out there. I have no affiliation with any of these companies, just so you know. But there are companies out there that are commercial companies that one can call. Again, they're FDA approved. So they're on label indication, and you can order them.
Are they? Okay. So almost, I mean, are these naturally occurring leeches that are just being harvested out of ponds somewhere?
No, I mean, these are grown. It's kind of like if you think about it with salmon. I mean, they're farm raised. Yeah,
leeches.
You can find wild salmon, certainly, and there are wild leeches.
Okay.
But for medicinal purposes, these are farmed, much like farm raised salmon.
Are there infection concerns given that they're sucking blood? Do leeches carry the potential of bacterial infection or something like that?
So they do, and that they have a bacteria that actually can go the other direction. So a patient can get infected with something usually called Aeromonas. It's not the only type of bacteria, but it is a type of bacteria that is found associated with leech therapy. And for that reason, those patients who go on leech therapy do need to be on proper antibiotics to help protect against that.
Mm. But that would it be the an automatic infection that if a leech attaches, or
no.
Would something have gone wrong?
It's not automatic, there is a chance. So that's why we know that, and we know it in advance. And that's why we go ahead and start the patient on antibiotics at the same time that they start on leech therapy. We're not waiting for them to get an infection and then starting antibiotics, but rather we're putting them on essentially preventative antibiotics.
How much blood in total would be taken from a patient through this process?
It really just depends. One other thing that maybe your listeners are wondering about that I would make mention of is if you think about it, if it's a large piece of tissue and it requires a fair number of leeches over a several day period and they're doing their job, then, you know, there is some bleeding that comes with that. And that
seems like blood loss would be potentially a problem.
That's right. So that is one of the downsides of this. And that's why it is possible that that some patients may need a blood transfusion. So that is another risk that is associated with leech therapy.
Mm. Another reason why it's a last-ditch thing.
That's
but
correct.
Mike, the question I had, though, in reading the paper that you published recently, Dr. Janis, is you're providing, you know, some guidelines for how to do this appropriately and effectively. But if the FDA, as I understand it, approved medicinal leeches 15 years ago, what more is there for doctors to understand about how to do it safely? Like, what's the disconnect?
So it's not necessarily a disconnect. The paper that we published is making sure it's a review paper. So there's not going to be anything brand new in this paper that was earth-shattering, but rather the point of the paper was that even though that this is, as you pointed out earlier, a centuries-old treatment that recently, as in like I think it was 2004, got approved by the FDA as on-label. So it has been on-label for 16 years. That people do need to be reminded from time to time that this is an acceptable and approved form of therapy, even if it's last line. There have been some recent developments around what kind of antibiotics do you give with leeches, because like anything else, sometimes leeches and the bacteria do get resistant to certain types of antibiotics. So we got to make sure everybody's completely up to date with the most latest scientific evidence on how to use these properly so that you have the lowest complication rate. That's also included in the study. So it's a review article that reminds people that even though this is a centuries-old treatment, it still has a modern indication.
Jeffrey Janis is a reconstructive surgeon at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. I spoke with him last year. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Once a week, the Top of Mind team dives into the archives to select conversations we'd like to hear again. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a Super Bowl champ who says he's even more proud of his reading accomplishments than he is of that ring. Just ahead, how beavers migrating north in Alaska are melting the permafrost and accelerating climate change. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. As temperatures in the Arctic warm, beavers are moving north from the boreal forests into the Alaskan tundra, where they are causing all kinds of trouble. Beavers dam rivers. And as they're doing that on the tundra, they've made dozens and dozens of new lakes that are flooding the permafrost. And that, researchers think, is releasing more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So promoting the climate change cycle. University of Alaska Fairbanks ecologist Ken Tape spoke with Top of Mind Ciara Hewlett last summer about how the beaver behavior is contributing to climate change.
Why would a beaver want to go live in the Arctic?
That's a great question. The two primary causes that we're looking at for this increase in beaver ponds in the Arctic tundra are rebound from overtrapping during the 19th and maybe early 20th century in Alaska. So there's lots of trapping of beavers, right? Hundreds of thousands of beaver pelts were exported from Alaska. So that's one possibility, is that they're just continuing that rebound, population rebound. And the other is that the climate is and the habitat is more favorable in the Arctic tundra than it has been in the last several centuries at least. And so longer summers. This is an animal that doesn't hibernate. It lives in its lodge during the winter, so the ice freezes down. It lives in its lodge, and then it's got to swim out and eat from its cache. So you can imagine that that's a really long winter, and they can't walk on the snow or anything like that. So the fact that there's more of this shrubby vegetation in the Arctic and a lot longer summers, shorter winters, we think that might be contributing to it as well.
So it's really, that's something that they like, is those longer summers, and that's due to climate change?
That's right, yeah. So, like I say, one part of the explanation may be this rebound from overtrapping, but the other one is climate change, and climate change is a complicated one. But basically, warmer, longer summers have led to a lot more shrubby vegetation, which is what the beavers need to eat in the tundra, and also a lot more unfrozen water. So you can imagine if you're a beaver and you live, you can't live in a stream that freezes to the bottom or a pond that freezes to the bottom in the winter. That just doesn't work. So you need that pond to escape from predators and to have this cache that you subsist on all winter.
So,
climate change, we think, is a important factor.
When I'm picturing the Arctic tundra, I'm thinking of snow and ice, but that doesn't sound like what you're describing here.
Well, that's a good picture for about 7 to 8 months of the year. Right now, the Arctic tundra is I would say in the middle of fall. It's red. It's turning red. It's beautiful. And you're getting below freezing temperatures at night. So starting, you know, about now until, you know, mid-May, you know, the snow really finally melts away, depending on where you are, you know. But in northern Alaska, in this tundra at least, that's about how long the winter is. But, yeah, in the summer, everything gets green, and for a few months, you know, you get plant growth and open creeks and things like that that the beaver can exploit for habitat.
So there are a lot of rivers and creeks and streams and that kind of thing for the beaver, and then and not a lot of are there not a lot of trees? Is it just kind of open space?
That's exactly it. Yeah, and the Arctic tundra is defined by being devoid of trees, and so yeah, there are no trees whatsoever. I mean, beavers are doing perfectly fine, at least for the last few decades, in places that don't have any trees. So they live off these shrubs that might be, you know, 10 or 15 or even 20 feet tall, and that's what they eat primarily.
Okay, so beavers are moving into the Arctic. They really like it there. Why is that a problem?
Well, we don't know that it's a problem. You know, we talked. You mentioned that study that we put out a few years ago, and we kind of made this discovery that beavers were moving into the tundra. And the reason we can see that is because we can see these ponds forming in satellite imagery that are constructed by beavers. The reality is, as we took a closer look, it's not 56, it's thousands, over 10,000. There's actually over 10,000 beaver ponds in the Alaska tundra. So there's quite a lot of these being formed. We don't know that it's a problem, but what happens is, all the ground in the tundra, this is another attribute of the tundra, is it's usually underlain by permafrost. So that means the ground's frozen year-round. If you go down a foot or two, the ground's frozen year-round. And that permafrost stores a whole lot of carbon. And what happens is when you build ponds or lakes or when you basically pool water on the landscape, that immediately starts thawing permafrost. So the concern is that with all these beaver ponds being constructed and streams being engineered across the tundra, at least parts of the tundra, that we're thawing a lot of permafrost and potentially mobilizing or releasing a lot of that carbon to the atmosphere.
So permafrost is important because it has that carbon and perhaps some methane too trapped inside of it, and then when it melts, it just releases it?
Yeah. That's you know, the shorthand explanation. I mean, obviously what happens is when that permafrost thaws, you know, that carbon is mobilized. First it enters the stream or the pond, right? And so you kind of have to trace that carbon, you know, as we call it, the pathways of that carbon, where exactly it goes. Is some redeposited in the pond bottom? Does that wetland actually trap more methane than it releases? And those are questions that we do not have answers to right now for the Arctic tundra. There are studies done in more temperate ecosystems, but it's complicated. Every one of these beaver ponds is different. And, you know, I'd say we're at about step 3 of 10 of actually understanding the implications of beavers moving into tundra. It's just in the last few years that we've even sort of realized that this is happening. So it's an exciting time for the research.
So connect the dots for me here. How does a beaver building a dam, creating a pond, because they built the dam on a stream or a creek or wherever, how does that melt permafrost?
That's a great question. It turns out water, the most of the Arctic tundra that has permafrost underneath it, the frozen soil is buffered, it's insulated from warm summer air temperatures, because we talked about the fact that it gets warm in the summer. So why doesn't it thaw down very deep and thaw that permafrost? And the reason is because it's got often a thick organic layer that is very insulating and is protecting the permafrost. And that is like a shield over the permafrost that keeps it fairly cold in the summer and allows those frozen soils to persist. And that's just what happens in most of the Arctic. You know, it's not, you don't get these very long summers, and the soil is allowed to remain frozen for most of the summer. So what happens is when you build a dam and flood an area, so you take what was a little creek that maybe was 10 or 15 or 20 feet wide, and you put a dam on it in a good spot, and beavers always pick the right spot. I don't know how they, I guess along many years of evolution, have allowed them to, you know, become pretty good engineers. They flood a large area of tundra, and what happens is that water that's sitting on top of the tundra absorbs heat much more readily than that dry tundra surface that existed before. And as a result, you are conducting heat, you're translating heat from the air down to the frozen soil beneath much more rapidly, and that's how you get thawed permafrost.
So the soil acts as a protective layer, and so maybe under the streams and any body of water, the permafrost wouldn't be there, but when you have that soil, it just protects it.
That's right. You know, right underneath the stream, that you have it exactly right. Right underneath the stream, you know, there often is no permafrost, or it's down pretty deep, you know, because there's water, there's no soil there, and there's also this warm source of water that's flowing over the stream bed that makes it a little bit deeper. But it's the areas everywhere else on the sides of these creeks where you have permafrost, and it's those areas being flooded that, you know, is of some concern. Yeah, a lot of beaver dams, though, like dams on sloughs, you know, like a slough of a river. You know, a beaver dam's a slough. That kind of location, you know, probably isn't going to thaw much permafrost. So it you know, it varies. There's a lot of variability. I mean, people listening have seen beaver dams in all sorts of different locations. They come in every variety. And so one of the challenges of this study is to be able to generalize about the implications when, in fact, they're very different from one pond to the next.
I'm speaking with Ken Tape. He's an ecologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So if these beavers have built thousands of new dams that have created new ponds and lakes in Alaska, what are the implications of that? If the permafrost, it's melting the permafrost, how big of a problem is that? Like, how much carbon is being released into the atmosphere?
That's a great question, and not one that we have an answer for right now. I think the permafrost question is really the one that's of primary, sort of broader concern. There's a lot of implications that are more of a concern locally and regionally. For example, implications to fish, implications for people who use these waterways for boat access, right? Because in Alaska, the rivers are the highways of these remote communities. They don't have any roads to speak of, and so they use these rivers and streams to get around. And so imagine that those all have roadblocks on them now, and it's a lot harder to get around, potentially some water quality issues. But I think fish is actually the big one. You know, salmon and other whitefish are a huge resource in Alaska, everywhere really, but particularly in these remote communities. And it again, another question that we're sort of at the beginning of doing the research to understand how beavers will affect fish in this environment.
Why do beavers build dams in the first place?
It's a great question. Beavers build dams. They don't always build dams, right? Some beavers have a bank lodge on a river or on a lake. And the reason that they need access to water that does not freeze to the bottom, you know, at least, you know, 6 or 8 feet deep at least, and they use that to avoid predators, so bears and wolves and maybe lynx and wolverines, animals like that, predate on beavers, and they use that deep water to escape those animals in both in summer and in winter. And of course, that water also acts as a place where they can store shrubs and saplings and things like that they've harvested during the summer, and then they can access it via water, this, you know, subaqueous underwater entrance to their lodge that, you know, predators can't get to. I did see a couple weeks ago, I came across a beaver lodge that maybe had been abandoned in the last 5 or 6 years, and the entire side of the lodge, it looked like it had been hit by a rocket or something on the side of the lodge. It was just completely dug out one side, and I'm pretty sure a bear just, you know, went directly into the side of this lodge and tried to dig out the beaver. But the beaver has, you know, 3 or 4 exits, and he probably got away.
So is this phenomenon a vicious cycle here because beavers are going more into the Arctic because they like that it's warmer, and so more permafrost has been melted, and then they in turn melt more permafrost by being there, and so then it's just going to kind of bring more beavers?
It seems that way. We call that, in science, we call that a positive feedback mechanism where it builds on itself, and it does seem that way. You know, there are some negative feedbacks. I mean, we talk about shrubs expanding in the Arctic. Well, when beavers come into these areas, they initially, you know, chew up a bunch of shrubs. But I think probably the long-term changes point in the direction of accelerating the effects of climate change on the landscape. And, you know, it's not a big deal if there's a few beaver ponds out there, you know, or a few dozen of them. It would be more of a novelty, but when you start seeing them, you know, by the thousands, and that's just in a fairly small area of Alaska tundra. I mean, most of the Alaska tundra is not occupied by beavers. So maybe a third of it or a quarter of it is occupied by beavers. And so, you know, looking to the future, it's both exciting and maybe a little bit scary to look at these vast tundra areas that don't have any beaver engineering and try to imagine how those will be different.
So
I mean, if you were a human developer, right? If you were a human developer and you went into the local land office and said, you know, I'd like to build three dams on every other stream in the tundra of Alaska, you know, they'd look at you funny.
Yeah,
it'd be a lot of paperwork. So
what needs to be done here? Do we need to hunt the beavers, get them out of there somehow, or what do you think needs to happen?
Oh, that's such a great question, and another one that we just don't have an answer for. What do we do? Is this a problem? Should we, you know, start shooting beavers, trapping beavers? Will that even do any good? I don't know, you know, and I don't live there either. I mean, I have lots of beavers where I live in Fairbanks in the middle of the state, but, you know, I think a lot of local communities probably want to weigh in that into that question as well, you know, as well as land managers like the National Park Service and Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I don't know what answers will emerge from that. That's a little bit beyond my scope, but I hope that we can provide some data and results that will inform whatever kind of mitigation plan they have in mind, which might be do nothing.
Ken Tape is an ecologist at University of Alaska Fairbanks. Top of Mind's Ciara Hewlett spoke with him last August. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, Super Bowl champ Malcolm Mitchell is proud of that Super Bowl ring, but he's even more proud of something else that will probably surprise you. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning in today to Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut of the show, and it is good to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. NFL teams are gearing up for the start of a new season next month, each with their eyes on a championship. Winning the Super Bowl is the ultimate accomplishment for a pro football player. Malcolm Mitchell caught six passes from quarterback Tom Brady to win the Super Bowl with the New England Patriots back in 2017. But you know what he is even more proud of? His reading accomplishments. At the start of this year, I spoke with Malcolm Mitchell about his reading advocacy and his latest picture book, which is called My Very Favorite Book in the Whole Wide World. Let's listen. You must encounter a lot of kids who look at you like you are nuts when you say, reading is a bigger deal for me than winning the Super Bowl.
It takes a few minutes to convince them.
What's the pitch? How do you convince them?
Well, I first talk about how reading has helped me get to where I'm at in my life. I also talk about how reading brought me to that present moment with them. It's not that football has allowed me to speak with them. It's reading has allowed me to speak with them. And then I go through some of the benefits associated with reading and how reading helped me become a better athlete. And usually that last point does the trick.
Like how has reading helped you become a better athlete?
Well, I tell students all the time, at some point in their life, they'll be surrounded by people just as physically athletic as they are. So that won't make them any better. What will make them better is their brain, their ability to process information and apply it in rapid speed, their ability to think critically, to make great decisions. That's what allows you to become a professional athlete. Because once you get to the NFL, everyone can run fast. Everyone is strong. Everyone can jump high. So what will separate you? And usually once I get on that path, some kids will lock in and start listening.
Mm. Especially, I imagine, the kids who consider themselves bad readers or who hate reading, quote unquote, which you can relate to. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and your relationship with reading.
Yes, I probably have a different approach to reading because I grew up a striving reader. In my book, I say some words are too big, some sentences too long, and some books too thick. And my reality was I was not a great reader. I was terrified of the process of reading. And I was extremely, extremely horrified by the idea of reading aloud in class, so much so that my behavior suffered from it. So when I go speak with kids, I tell them, no, I completely understand the challenges because I've dealt with them. I dealt with them as a 19-year-old. I dealt with them in my adulthood, but it's overcoming that fear that allowed me to really reap the benefits of reading. And what happened is my future and opportunities became unlocked, and it was just provided great chances for me to learn and grow.
So by the time you got to college, which you did on the merits of your athleticism, right? You get to college, you're a football player, but what was your reading ability at that point?
It was subpar. I would say middle school at the most. I wasn't completely illiterate. I could understand information and understood the process of using context clues to solve problems. So I don't want to give off the vibe as if I was completely illiterate. That wasn't the case. I just was not on grade level by any means.
How did that affect your life?
Once I got to college and I became immersed in a diverse culture, it had a huge impact. Grocery shopping became a challenge. I had a hard time reading the labels and picking up the right items. Watching movies and subtitles flying on and off the screen became challenging. I felt inferior in the classroom amongst my peers in college. I felt I was not being the best version of myself, and that troubled me. I think it's, as an athlete, I think it's one thing to say you're a good athlete, but being a good athlete is not the same as testifying that you're doing your best to be the best version of you. I think those are two different things. And at that time in my life, I believe I was doing the best I could at being the best athlete I could be, but I was doing a poor job of being the best Malcolm I could be. And reading definitely helped me change that around.
What changed for you? How did you improve your reading skills?
I improved my reading skills by starting from scratch. I figured if I took the same process to becoming a good athlete to becoming a better reader, eventually it would work out. So that meant started with picture books, which explains why I became a picture book author. As a 19, 20-year-old athlete at the University of Georgia who had just become the All-SEC Freshman of the Year and known around campus for my athletic ability, I was in a local Barnes & Noble sitting down reading picture books trying to teach myself how to read.
Wow.
Yeah, it was humbling, but I knew it needed to be done. I had consumed all this information, such as the grocery shopping experience, the subtitle experience, and then I watched interviews with people I had deemed successful: Warren Buffett, Oprah Winfrey, Sean Carter, aka Jay-Z. And each of these individuals, when I watched interviews of them, had one thing that all resonated with them and it was books. They would talk about their specific field, and they would always reference books contributing to their success in some form, whether it was Warren Buffett mentioning reading to help him make better decisions on the stocks he picked, Jay-Z reading to increase his vocabulary, or Oprah Winfrey reading to help her learn more and build more empathy for an individual. It's those things that made me say, okay, there's something to this reading thing, and I need to figure it out.
Were you on your own, Malcolm Mitchell, when you decided to figure it out?
For a little while. You know, running through the street telling people you're not a great reader isn't the most popular idea. So I kept it to myself. Eventually it came out. I joined a book club while I was in college, and that began to spread a little bit. So people found out that I was on this journey to become a more literate human being. And ironically, there are millions of people who reached out telling me about their struggles as well.
I'm speaking with Malcolm Mitchell, Super Bowl champion. He's founder of the Read with Malcolm Initiative, author of a couple of picture books, and his latest is called My Very Favorite Book in the Whole Wide World. So this book is about a boy named Henley, who you say in the intro is a version of you. What is the thing that Henley is struggling with? What's his big concern in this book?
Henley is struggling to find his very favorite book in the whole wide world. There's this misconception that he hates to read, which is simply not true. He just hasn't found a book that resonates with him. And it's funny because 85% of the book, Henley goes on this journey trying to find his favorite book and really never does. You know?
Yeah.
It's from guidance from his mother gives him another idea.
Yeah. There's a moment where he's talking about, he's like, I don't hate reading. I just haven't figured out how to enjoy it. but
which is true. I did not enjoy reading for a very long time, or the idea of it, because it's the way I perceived it.
There's a scene where he sees other kids enjoying reading, and he feels like that hurts him. Did you feel that as a kid?
Yes. I remember when the class was reading The Outsiders or To Kill a Mockingbird, Romeo and Juliet. There are some other books also that I didn't enjoy those books until I became an adult, when I found the courage to read them on my own. Mm-hmm. But sitting in class afraid that you'd be called on to read kind of distracted me from the pleasure of the book. So when classmates began talking about it, I couldn't join in on the conversations, nor could I appreciate the experience that they had. And that's a very isolated and lonely place to be.
What is a response you've received from a child who's read your books that sticks with you?
Usually when a child says they struggle to read, but I've encouraged them to try, that really resonates with me, because that's all I'm trying to do. Give them the motivation and courage it takes to try to absorb this skill that will help them unlock their potential and build a better future for themselves. That's what I'm really trying to accomplish, getting these kids to believe in themselves and possess the tools that reading gives you to build a better future in life. So anytime a child comes up to me saying they struggle to read, but because of the book or my story, they're going to try, that always resonates with me.
What led you to become an author, to decide, not only am I going to promote reading, I'm going to make stuff that people can read?
Okay. It's very, honestly, I think it was very logical, which I'm not always, but I was in a bookstore and I was in a children's book section picking out some of my favorite picture books. And I thought to myself, you know, I was this college athlete with a decent amount of popularity. And everyone wanted to hear what I had to say. I'll get interviewed after every game. I had thousands and thousands of followers on social media, even, I mean, that was what, maybe 10 years ago. And
yeah, even in the early days, that's good.
Right. And I thought all these people are willing to listen to me for whatever reason. So maybe I should give them, or maybe I should say something of importance that will help them in their life. I was engulfed by the positive changes reading had in my life. So I said, fine, if people want to listen to me, I'll say something, but what I'm going to say is going to be based around reading. And since I can't be everywhere at once, what can be? And I thought about books. I said, a book can be anywhere at any given time, regardless of where I am physically located. So I'll write books to encourage kids and people around the world to fall in love with reading. And that's what made me become a picture book author. This idea of this traveling book that would encourage students to be readers.
What's the Read with Malcolm literacy initiative?
So Read with Malcolm is what was created in 2015. It's a literacy programs in school and virtual programs to encourage kids to read. We also introduced book ownership into the lives of students who can't afford books. And we've been doing that for several years now. Right now we're in the middle of our biggest competition, which is Read Bowl, where classrooms around the country and in other countries can compete to see who can read the most minutes in a 4-week time span.
Hmm. And it's about minutes, not about pages or books, which
it's about minutes. Yes.
Yeah. And you say you introduced the concept of book ownership. What do you mean?
So 1 in 300 kids in low income communities don't have age appropriate books, nor can they afford them. It's an important topic because these are the things that I lived. I was in a household where you had to make the choice of a $15 book or going to the store to buy $15 worth of groceries so you could eat that night. Well, it's not really a hard decision to make, correct? Mm. But there are consequences for not having books at home. Kids don't have the comfort it takes to become avid readers. They don't have the familiarity to randomly pick up a book and begin to enjoy the process of reading. So book ownership is a really, really big deal in terms of not just promoting the book, but giving kids access to books so they can take that encouragement and then apply it. You know, it's really hard to promote reading and expect the kid to get the benefit from it if they don't have a book. And I think sometimes we forget that books are really expensive. It's easier to buy a bag of Skittles than a book.
What advice do you have for parents who are concerned about a child of their own who seems to hate reading?
As a new father, I noticed that kids usually mimic their parents or an adult figure in their life. I don't think it takes a lecture or a massive amount of encouragement. If you read, if your child sees you with the book or a magazine or a newspaper, well, they're more likely to pick up that habit.
That's Malcolm Mitchell, Super Bowl champion, literacy advocate. He is founder of the Read with Malcolm initiative, and his most recent children's book is a picture book called My Very Favorite Book in the Whole Wide World. I spoke with him just after the book was published in January of this year. And that's it for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's great having you with us today. It's easy to get angry at someone who refuses to believe scientific evidence that you find impossible to ignore, something about vaccines, say, or climate change. But we're all susceptible to denying science, and it's not entirely our fault. We're swimming in misleading information, and we're wired to doubt a lot of stuff that's true. Plus, scientists do change their minds about things. So how can we ever know when to doubt and when to trust? Recently on Top of Mind, we spoke with psychologists Barbara Hofer and Gail Sinatra about why science denial happens and what to do about it. Look for that conversation on our website, byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.